Hey, it's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly check-in on presidential campaign politics with Harry Enten from 538.com.
First, Milwaukee saw protests and violence erupt over the weekend after a police officer shot and killed a man on Saturday. Police sources have said the man was armed. Since then, questions about police relations and the city's racial divisions are back in the spotlight.
23-year-old Silval Smith was fatally shot by a 24-year-old Milwaukee police officer, also an African-American man. The police department has placed the officer on administrative leave and has not yet released his name. His name and picture have been shared on social media, and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel later confirmed his identity.
Joining us now to tell us more is Gina Barton. She's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's criminal justice investigative reporter and has been covering the events in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood. Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Gina, unrest in Milwaukee seems to have simmered down since the weekend, but it sounds like there's an opposite story taking place on social media with things ramping up. What's been happening there?
During the past several days, we've seen lots of people on social media threatening not only this particular police officer, but also the police in general. As of late yesterday, more than 3,000 people on Facebook had shared a photo of the officer, some of them adding furious and threatening comments.
And along the way, in your coverage of this story, the Journal Sentinel made the decision to identify the officer involved, even though the Milwaukee Police Department hasn't released his name. How did you make that decision?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question. It was a really long process that involved about 10 people having a conversation for an hour about what we do. And generally, we don't wait on the police to release information if we can confirm it. I mean, if we waited on that, we wouldn't be able to report a lot of the things we report that are worth reporting. So once we had confirmation of the name, not only from the social media posts, but also from several other sources, we had a discussion about it. And in the end, we concluded that we were not going to print the picture because if people who didn't know what he looked like, we didn't want to give them that information. But in the end, thousands of people are putting out his photo, his name, some of them even his address. Everybody in the neighborhood knows who he is. Everybody who wants to threaten him is threatening him by name and with his picture. So we wanted to tell the citizens about the threats faced by the officer. We wanted to hold government officials accountable in responding to those threats. And under state law, the officer's name will come out once the investigation is concluded.
And because you know who he is, you were able to research his relationship with the community. What did you find?
And we're still doing some more work on that. But what we find is that he grew up in the Sherman Park neighborhood and that he and the man he shot over the weekend did know each other. We don't know how well they knew each other. We don't know if they were friends or whether it was just a simple acquaintanceship, but they did know each other. And one took the path toward law enforcement, and the other one, you know, seemed to take a different path.
And so the threats you mentioned toward this officer, are they directed mostly at him personally, or has this taken on a broader scope toward police in general?
Well, there was no way that we could read every single one, although we tried. but there were some very specific threats as, you know, now you all see his face. If he's anywhere in the city, drop him. Or, you know, get me a gun so I can shoot him right in the head. So those were some really specific threats. And then some other of the threats and comments were directed toward police in general. You know, we want an eye for an eye, no more peace, that kind of stuff. And I think it's important to note that on Monday afternoon, the District 7 police station was briefly closed because of threats and shots being fired nearby.
Gina Barton from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is with us right now to give us the latest on the aftermath of the police shooting that sparked violence in Milwaukee over the weekend. And Gina, you've been telling us about some of these threats shared on social media along with the identity of the officer involved. How seriously is the police department taking these threats?
Well, they tell us that they're taking them very seriously and that they have detectives working on it. part of the issue I think that they're going to need to get to the bottom of is people aren't using their own names, and a lot of these Facebook accounts don't have their real names on them. But I think it will probably be possible for them to figure out who these people are making the threats. And not that long ago, there was a man in Racine who was charged and convicted for making threats against police on social media. So there is precedent for it.
There's precedent. Does that happen often, or is it still pretty rare?
Well, doing our research yesterday, we only came across a couple of cases, one of them local. But so I would say it's pretty rare for this area. But then again, the kind of thing that happened over the weekend is really unusual for this area also. So I think the game has changed now.
Now that the officer's identity is out there, it's on social media, it's been published in the Journal Sentinel, for instance, does this put pressure on the Milwaukee Police Department, do you think, to release more information, maybe not even just the identity of the officer, but also the footage from the body camera, for instance?
Well, and that's another thing that we're hearing today is people in the community are really frustrated that the footage from the body camera hasn't been released yet. And their view is, if this really shows that Smith had a gun and was pointing it at the officer, why aren't they showing it to us? They could put all of this to rest just by showing us the proof of what they're saying. On the other hand, the police generally do not release body cam or squad cam footage until after the investigation is complete, and that's for a lot of reasons. I think an additional reason here is because this footage, no matter what it shows about the interaction between the officer and the citizen, does show the moments of a man being shot to death. And that is a really emotional thing to see. And I think part of the fear might be that they you know, think there could be further unrest if people viscerally react to seeing film of that.
How vocal has the Smith family been about the shooting? What have they been saying?
Well, I don't think the Smith family is speaking of one as one. The night that this all happened, his mother and his aunt were out in the street trying to get people to calm down and, you know, to not cause trouble, to not use violence. But then there have been some other interviews that other family members have done where they're just angry. And so I think obviously their anger is really justified. And I think that city officials and people in the neighborhood really have a challenge in front of them to try and make sure that everybody remains calm as the investigation continues.
And you've been following this story, have been reporting on it in the context of the community and its history. How would you describe the nature of this relationship now and in the past between police and this particular neighborhood?
Well, Sherman Park was once a fairly thriving neighborhood filled with factory workers, you know, working class, but they were able to make a living wage and generally considered a pretty stable, somewhat prosperous neighborhood. I would say in about the past 5 years, that's deteriorated a little bit. Obviously, the loss of manufacturing jobs happened before that, but in recent years, there have been more conflicts. About 5 years ago, there was another somewhat violent confrontation between citizens and police. Didn't rise to the level of this one, but you know, it was kind of scary for a lot of people. And there have also been interactions between some of the business owners who don't live in that community and the residents. There was the owner of the BP, in fact, fired a gun into the air maybe a couple of weeks or months ago to try and get some unruly youths away from the store, and everybody took that pretty personally. So it's been simmering for a while.
Gina, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Gina Barton. She's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's criminal justice investigative reporter, and she was with us there to give us the latest on the aftermath of the police shooting that sparked violence in Milwaukee over the weekend. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin college president shares his thoughts on how to discuss Donald Trump's candidacy with his students.
Right now, it's time for a weekly look at the latest from the campaign trail with Harry Enten from 538. This week, Senate Republican candidates are worried about the impact of low polling numbers for Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton's campaign is looking to lure Republicans, and both campaigns made stops in Wisconsin.
Harry Enten is a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
I'm glad to be back.
Big picture, Harry, what are the latest polls showing in this presidential race?
I mean, look, they're showing what they've shown for the last 2.5, 3 weeks since the Democratic National Convention finished, which is that Hillary Clinton has a lead nationally of probably somewhere between 6 and 8 percentage points. And when you translate that down to the Electoral College level, which is obviously where the playing field is in presidential elections in this country, she has a lead of greater than 9 percentage points or greater in the polls in enough states to reach 273 electoral votes, and all you need is 270 to win. So she's a heavy favorite right now.
And in terms of how significant that 9-point lead is, put it in context. How big is it?
I mean, if you look back over the past few cycles, it's pretty large. I mean, remember, obviously, last election cycle, we had a pretty close campaign in 2008 at this point. Barack Obama was leading, but only by about 3 to 4 points. George W. Bush was leading at this point in the 2004 election, but not by that much. You'd have to go all the way back to 1996 when Bill Clinton was able to win re-election over Bob Dole to have anything that was greater than the lead that Clinton has right now.
This has Republicans worried not just about the presidential race, but you write that a Senate candidate may be at risk because of Donald Trump's polling numbers. What are you seeing?
Well, what we essentially have seen over the past few cycles is we've seen an increasingly strong relationship between how people vote on the presidential level and how they vote on the Senate level. It used to be, say, 20 years ago, people were much more willing to split their tickets. That's not the case anymore. So if you look at the polls where they were in the Senate races, say, 3 weeks ago, or not even three weeks ago, we see that there has been movement away from the Republican candidates towards the Democratic candidates at about the same rate we've seen voters move from Donald Trump to Hillary Clinton, so that now Democratic Senate candidates lead in enough states so that if the election were held today, Democrats would be favored to take over the United States Senate.
How quickly do the polls move? I mean, you're seeing this now. We've got, you know, about 3 months or so till the election. So if there were to be a major swing in the other direction, is there enough time for that to happen?
I mean, there's enough time whereby, you know, we obviously run our models here. And if you look specifically just at the polls, we know that in the past, about this lead would hold about 90% of the time. But that's still 10% of the time it didn't. So that, for instance, if you go back to the 1980 campaign, at this point, Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter were about tied. Reagan ended up winning that election by about 10 percentage points. If you go back to 1976, Jimmy Carter held a double-digit lead over Gerald Ford, and the race got so tight by election day that Gerald Ford actually led in the final Gallup poll, even though Carter ultimately won by just a few points. So there is time for Trump to come back, but most candidates in Trump's position do not.
Well, one candidate in Trump's position is changing leadership in his campaign. Donald Trump's campaign announced this week two new leaders, different names than campaign manager, but one staffer coming from the conservative Breitbart news site. What do you make of that? A lot of people are saying there's a message here.
Well, I make of it a few things. Number one, you don't change campaign managers or whatever the heck he wants to call them unless you're losing. And so I think it's an acknowledgement that he's probably losing this campaign. I think the other thing that has become clear from this is that Donald Trump still believes he's running a primary campaign, and he wants to double down on what had worked during the primary in the hopes that it will work in the general election. But there's just no sign of that. And then finally, I'd note, look, I think Donald Trump realizes that this may be his last shot in the limelight, so he might as well go down with people who are telling him what he wants to hear, and what he wants to hear is probably what somebody at Breitbart is saying.
There has been not quite rising to the level of buzz, but there have been whispers about whether Donald Trump would drop out. It's too late for that now, isn't it?
I mean, he could. Look, the man can do whatever he wants to do in terms of he has free will. No one could stop him. No one could put a gun to his head. But if we're being realistic, it is too late insofar as that he is going to be the Republican nominee as he is right now. The rest of it, to me, sounds like a fantasy. But, you know, at this year, I would acknowledge that pretty much anything can happen. So I don't put it past Trump, but it's likely not to happen.
Talking about the latest in presidential politics with Harry Enten from 538.com. One thing we've seen from the Republican Party, a lot of Republican officials, former electeds, other staffers, things like that, wrote a petition to the Republican National Committee saying, basically, let's cut bait, stop putting money into the Trump campaign, let's focus on Congress, the House, and the Senate. This is something we haven't seen very often, isn't it?
And not this early. I mean, in 96, there was the whole idea, we'll divert funds away from Bob Dole because he's down by double digits, and we'll try and hold the Senate and the House. But that didn't happen until late September, October. We're right now still in the middle of August. And so I think that there's a real recognition going on that you've seen the Senate numbers shift. We have seen some shifts in the National House generic ballot, though we haven't necessarily got an in-depth district-by-district polling. And so I think that there's a recognition from some Republicans that let's get off this train now, or let's at least try to fortify our Senate and House candidates to ensure that they are not infected with whatever it is that is bringing Donald Trump down.
We're talking to Harry Enten from 538.com, looking at the latest in presidential politics. And Harry, Hillary Clinton is looking to encourage Trump supporters, Republicans, to leave his camp and come over to her. She launched a new organization aimed at doing just that. Do you think it's going to be successful?
I mean, look, at the end of the day, most Republicans are going to vote for Donald Trump. However, if you look at the polls, you do see that at least about 20% of Republicans at this point are not saying that they're going to vote for Trump. Some polls have it as high as 30%. If you're trying to win an election in this country, you want to be able to appeal as many voters as possible. And I think if you're Hillary Clinton, you'd like as much of a mandate, or at least as much of a perceived mandate as possible. So to me, this is not a bad idea. Is it going to get that many voters? Maybe not, but I don't think that you do everything just because you know it's going to work. You do some things because you believe it might work, and it definitely won't harm you. And that's something Hillary Clinton's done very well by building a campaign apparatus that has allowed her to take advantage of Donald Trump's stumbles and has allowed her to build a field team in a number of swing states that has allowed her to gain a large advantage over Trump.
Speaking of swing states, Harry, we keep getting candidate visits. Tim Kaine was in Wisconsin yesterday raising money. Donald Trump, made another visit, actually three separate events in Wisconsin. We'll get into what Trump had to say in West Bend in just a bit. But the fact that we keep getting these visits from the campaigns here, polls show a big lead for Hillary Clinton. Does that just say how important Wisconsin is in the electoral college math for one or both of the campaigns?
I think, you know, there is an acknowledgement if you put together an electoral map right now of where Hillary Clinton holds large leads, Wisconsin is part of that. And if Wisconsin leaves that, then all of a sudden you can say, okay, if Trump were somehow to make a play in Wisconsin, then you add it with Florida and Ohio, then there's a real shot for Donald Trump. So I think that this is just being cautious on part of the Clinton campaign. They recognize that this is a state that they really should be winning. It's a state Democrats normally win. And I think Trump recognizes that if he really wants to be able to play to these white working class voters as he has claimed that he wants to, then there's no better starting place than Wisconsin.
And Tim Kaine was in Wisconsin yesterday, Donald Trump too, as we said. And we have a little bit of Donald Trump reaching out to African-American voters.
The Democratic Party has failed and betrayed the African-American community. Democratic crime policies, education policies, and economic policies have produced only more crime, more broken homes, and more poverty.
And that from yesterday, Donald Trump reaching out to African-American voters. I saw on Twitter yesterday, I think Newt Gingrich saying if this is a new tactic, a new vein of Trump developing this idea, reaching out to African-American voters, it could be big. What do you think? How is that working?
I think even Gingrich might have said that it was one of the most successful outreach programs any Republican has ever made to the African-American community, to which some people joked around, what about Lincoln? I mean, look, it's not a bad idea. Again, if you're running for president, you should reach out to as many voters as possible. But I don't think a speech like that necessarily works to reach out to the African-American community when you're giving it in a mostly white town or white city instead of in downtown Milwaukee, which is where most African-Americans in the state of Wisconsin live. So I get it, but I think in all honesty, what that speech is really geared towards is trying to appeal to some people, some white people, to assure them that he is not racist. I think that there's a lot of white folks who think that Donald Trump, there is somehow something prejudiced about him, and he wants to reassure them that he's not. And I think a message like that certainly doesn't hurt. It was one of his more elegant statements so far of the campaign. So, I mean, it doesn't hurt, but chances are Donald Trump is still only going to end up with 1 to maybe 5% of the African-American vote.
Yeah, you've written about polling and African-American voters in Donald Trump. And where is he coming in among the presidential candidates?
He is coming in fourth place. It's pretty amazing. Fourth place. He's behind Hillary Clinton, Gary Johnson, and Jill Stein.
And by contrast, Hillary Clinton, how is she? Does she still have a big advantage there?
She has, I think, depending on which poll you look at, she's right now about in the mid-80s. Some polls have her a little bit higher. I think the average is about 85-86%. That's a little worse than Barack Obama did. Perhaps that's not so surprising, but remember, we also have four candidates, two minor party candidates who are getting a greater share of the overall vote. So it's not so shocking that Clinton's running a little worse than Barack Obama did 4 and 8 years ago, but she still holds a massive lead, and that lead is certainly large enough to help her win the election if it holds.
Now, finally, Harry, as we wrap up, we understand via social media you're in the midst of an outreach effort of your own. Let's give a listen.
Because he's Wizkid Harry Anton. He's Wizkid Harry Anton. He's Wizkid
Hold
Harry
on.
Anton. He's looking for a girlfriend.
So, Harry, you've gone on Twitter. We're embarrassing you here. Looking for a girlfriend. Now, I know you're focusing on the New York City area. Could you make it work for a potential soulmate here in Wisconsin?
If it were the right one, sure, why not? I will say, at least in the past, I had one long-term relationship, and it didn't end up working out, so I'm a little sour on it. But, hey, if it works out, if there's someone great out there, there ain't no mountain high enough, ain't no river valley low enough, or however the song goes.
Why are you looking for a girlfriend now? Aren't you kind of busy, you know, with the election?
Hey, look, we all need romance in our lives.
All right.
Well, Harry, thank you so much, and good luck in that journey.
Thank you so much.
That's Harry Anton, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com.
Coming up after the news, the president of Ripon College joins us to talk about how he thinks professors should talk about the rise of Donald Trump with their students. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farrow. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, a new program helps people gain insight into what it's like to have dementia, and that can lead to businesses that are more welcoming to people living with the disease.
First, the president of Wisconsin's Ripon College recently wrote an opinion piece published in the Washington Post, which is linked, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. In it, he talked about how he'll teach his political science students about the campaign of Donald Trump.
Joining us now is Zach Massetti. He's president of Ripon College, as well as a professor of politics and government. Zach, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
Well, what made you want to write a piece for the Washington Post about how to teach Donald Trump to your students?
Well, you know, I was thinking as the semester was about to begin, and this is probably colleges all over the country are facing this, which is here you have a candidate who has really said some things that, as I wrote in the piece, might have you end up in the dean's office for not being particularly thoughtful or sensitive to your fellow classmates. How do you teach that? And in particular, how do you respect the views and the opinions of someone who may agree with him but may be very much in the minority in classroom? Because, as you know, polls show, particularly among young people, that Donald Trump is trailing significantly by as much as almost 40 percentage points.
And what did you come up with? How do you make space for a diversity of viewpoints about Donald Trump?
Well, I think the first thing is you have to, as you don't necessarily as a professor check your opinions when you come into the classroom. You're not just a referee. You're there to talk about important points and things that you believe. I think you can acknowledge that this is a presidential campaign like one we've never seen before and a candidate like one we've never seen before. That said, I think you also have to be respectful and thoughtful, and you have to listen to what young people say about why they support Donald Trump, and you have to, even when things get heated, allow for their point of view to be heard.
Right. You write that what you don't want is students who might support Trump to feel maybe that they're not being heard or that they're marginalized. And you don't want them to retreat into spaces like Yik Yak, where they sound off without open dialogue. Why is that open dialogue part so important to you?
I think this idea of expanding your perspectives organically, I mean, doing it in a way where you're hearing what your classmates have to say, you're reading different points of view. I mean, one of the things that's happened, and I think in our society over the last 25 years or so, is that we're really in echo chambers like we've never been before. We're listening to the same points of view that reaffirm what we already believe. And Yik Yak and comment sections off, you know, articles like the one I wrote allow people to be incredibly angry and hateful and vitriolic without stepping up and saying, but here's who I am, right? Here's my name. Here's where I come from. Here's why I believe what I believe. And, you know, oftentimes people get their views politically from their parents or their grandparents, and they haven't necessarily thought them through. And that cuts both ways, both left and right.
Right. I mean, we live in an era when, I don't know if politics mirrors society or society mirrors politics, but we're not in a civil era right now. So is it really even possible to create that in a classroom?
You know, it's a great question, and to be honest, I don't know that you are, but if you can't create it in the classroom, where are you going to create it? I mean, this is in some ways still, you know, the great polis, right? The classroom is still the place, and in college communities, particularly residential colleges, this place where you're part of a community. And the idea, I think, that Americans have to get around here in the next coming decade is, look, I may not agree with my, as I write in the article, my cousin's husband or my next-door neighbor or my kid's softball coach on politics, but boy, there are some things that we do share in common. Some of those things may be political, but some of them may just be that we share a love of sports or art or music, and once you find that common ground, boy, there are lots of things that are possible. I think we've lost some of that in the country over the last couple of decades where we've lost this idea that, you know, there are things we share in common.
We're talking with Zach Massetti right now, 13th president of Ripon College, also a professor in the Politics and Government Department, talking about his piece in the Washington Post, examining how to best teach the candidacy of Donald Trump to students come the start of the semester. And one thing you hope is that this is not something that stays confined to the halls of poli sci, but that it goes beyond to other disciplines at the university. Why do you think that's important?
Thanks, Veronica, for asking that, because Donald Trump's candidacy to me seems in particular, although you could make the argument also about Secretary Clinton, that it's sort of tailor-made for a liberal arts college curriculum. It's really not just about political science, and I think that's part of the reason why the country seems so obsessively fascinated by this. You can look at this through the lens of history, economics, literature, certainly psychology, and the kinds of words that people are throwing around here are words that really go way beyond what you might learn in a political science class. What does it mean to have empathy? What does it mean to be narcissistic? These are really important concepts that you draw upon really from many different disciplines in order to understand them. And I think, you know, given how the country's been focused on this, and this will be true of our students and many students around the country, this is a discussion that's going to take place not just in the classroom, but in the cafeteria, probably at Friday night parties as well. And, you know, you want students to talk about it in a way where they're learning from each other.
And so a little bit earlier, you mentioned Hillary Clinton and comment sections, and I think it was in the comment section to this article, people have said, well, why aren't you, you know, exerting the same sort of lens to Hillary Clinton?
You know, again, I think there's something to be said for that you could write an article here about Secretary Clinton. What I think, though, is important to distinguish is that somehow that there's relativism between her candidacy and the candidacy of Donald Trump in terms of this particular issue of civility and civil discourse, right? There are clearly questions about Secretary Clinton's past and her history and question of how, whether she's been truthful all the way through her career, which, by the way, if you can find me a politician who has been truthful all the way there through their career, I'd like to know who that person is. But there are certainly questions that you should debate about Hillary Clinton's candidacy as well. But this question of civil discourse, civility, how we treat each other in public life, how we call each other, the language we use, Donald Trump has set a different standard by design, and that, I think, promotes a certain set of challenges for educators around the country.
Aside from those words that you just mentioned, empathy and looking at language and things like that, what are the big lessons that you think this presidential race can teach us? I mean, looking at things like the media, for instance, and critical thinking, all of that.
Well, I hope, you know, I think people are starting to already think very seriously now about what our political system looks like on November 9th, and the day after the election, and what do we do. And I do hope one of the lessons that people draw from this is that there is a way to talk to each other in public that even sometimes if it sounds forced and you have to talk about my great friend from the state of South Carolina, even if you may not think that person is the great friend from South Carolina, that these conventions, these linguistic conventions, are important, because at the end of the day, we're all Americans and we all hopefully want what's best for our country, even if we have different means of getting there. And I think returning to this idea that it's not okay to make fun of different groups of people. It's not okay to call people stupid. And I think about it in the context really here of, you know, if some of the things that candidate Trump has called individuals, that if he would have called that about my children or any of my students here, I would have been very upset by it and thought, hey, in a public space, there's a certain civility that you have to have with people. You can say and believe whatever you want, but in a public space, you have a certain responsibility to promote a civil discourse between people to try and find the best ideas.
Now, Donald Trump has said in his candidacy that he doesn't have time to be politically correct to the letter. And you have been criticized for this piece for being part of the liberal academic elite. I mean, how would you address those charges from people who may in your class support Donald Trump, maybe other fellow staff members?
Here's my response to that is if politically correct means that I don't think you should make fun of people with disabilities in public, or I don't think you should talk about I don't think there are certain things you should say about women in a public setting, then count me in as politically correct, because I just believe that there is a fundamental civil discourse that needs to occur between people in public forum. It doesn't mean you can't say and do whatever it is you want. You certainly can, but there's a certain amount of just basic decency you need to have with people, particularly when you're in a public setting.
And you've said in your piece that whether or not Donald Trump wins this election, that you see this as really just the beginning of this conversation, and that it has to happen not just in the classroom, but in society at large. So how do you see that playing out?
Well, I mean, again, you know, look, it looks like when you read all the polls, and I know you just had a guest on from 538 before I was on, you know, that the election certainly seems to be tilting in one direction here. And unless something dramatic happens in the next couple of months, the next president will be Hillary Clinton. But what do we say to the 40% or whatever the number is of people that voted for Donald Trump in this election and supported him? How do those people come back into a political fold where we're working together to try and find solutions in the country? To me, that's sort of the million-dollar question for the next decade, which is there is, and there used to be in this country, a sensible middle between left and right, where people came together and they didn't always get everything they wanted, but they found compromises and ended up moving the country forward. We need to figure out how to return to that space.
Zach, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Zach Massetti, 13th president of Ripon College and a professor in the Politics and Government Department. His Washington Post piece about how to teach Trump is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, a new initiative in one Wisconsin county aims to make more businesses and government agencies friendly to people with dementia. That's coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, methamphetamine use has been on the rise in northern and western Wisconsin. We'll talk to an official in Chippewa County about what's going on.
First, it can be difficult for someone who doesn't have dementia to imagine what it's like to live with that condition. Those who are taking care of someone with dementia might have some special insights, but even they see it from the outside.
But a new program in Dane County is working to help people get a glimpse into what it's like to live with dementia and to help them to use that knowledge to make their businesses and government agencies more friendly to those living with the condition. Joy Schmidt joins us now. She's a dementia care specialist with the Dane County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Joy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with terminology. So what does it mean to be dementia-friendly?
For businesses, that means being aware, being understanding, having their staff and their employees given the education to recognize that somebody has maybe struggling with memory issues, and then that they are better able to communicate with them. So for a community, it just means awareness and understanding.
So when it comes to a business, and I know you're beginning to work with businesses in Dane County, what changes about the way that that business or maybe a government agency works if they strive to be dementia-friendly?
What changes is that they have a little bit better understanding of what dementia is, the fact that dementia can be caused by a variety of illnesses, and then that they may change their approach in how they, you know, provide their service, their customer service. They may also look at their environments, maybe change signs, make things a little bit easier and maybe more accessible for the person with dementia.
Now, one of the ways that you get there is by doing some really unusual stuff, as I understand it. You want the people who say, work at a business to understand what it feels like, to have dementia. How do you go about accomplishing that?
We've been doing that in a variety of ways. But one of the ways we did that recently was in a Walgreens, worked with their managers and then their employees, and we had them put on goggles that we taped up and made it more difficult for them to see, basically taking away their peripheral vision and depth perception, so their vision was affected. Then we had them put cotton balls in their ears. We had them put gloves on, like surgical gloves, and taped their fingers, and put popcorn kernels in their shoes. All of these things basically to give them the experience of a person both with maybe cognitive impairments but also other disabilities. And then we had them shop for items in their own store. So we gave them a list and had them shop for these items and have that experience of what it might be for their customers. So really an empathy experience.
And you can understand that based on all of these differences to the way they perceive the world around them, this must be very different. What do they tell you about what it feels like?
It really has been eye-opening for them, and it was wonderful to kind of see that epiphany. But what they say is, wow, you know, oh my gosh, I had no idea what this, just that it's really challenging. And so just, you know, light bulbs going on as far as, you know, I really understand what maybe why their customer might get frustrated and maybe overwhelmed and why they may, you know, act a certain way if they're having to deal with this on a day-to-day basis. We've also had customers in the store, you know, maybe their caregivers or maybe someone who has had that experience, and they commended the store for taking that time to educate their employees.
And so have you heard back? Do you check back later and say, okay, you went through this empathy exercise to see what it's like. What are you doing differently now?
We have. And, you know, I think what the employees, what the managers said to us is it just changes how we approach our customers. It changes, you know, gives us that recognition that maybe we need to approach from the front. Maybe we need to make sure that they, you know, they know we're there before we speak, that we make good eye contact, that we, you know, smile and speak clearly and maybe simplify things, sometimes use gestures. So it's all kind of, a lot of it's focused on nonverbal communication and how we change, you know, how we respond to them, how we respond to our customers, by changing our facial expression, by changing our approach.
We're talking with Joy Schmidt right now. She's a dementia care specialist with the Dane County Aging and Disability Resource Center. And Joy, tell us what a business has to do to be considered dementia friendly.
A business needs to have trained at least 50% or more of its staff. They need to have management bought into this, so management really needs to take this seriously and then also carry it forward. Since we can't always come back and train new employees, managers agree to educate their new employees and to talk about it periodically with their staff. And then they have to also be open to environment changes, suggestions that we make about signage and other things that they can do, including increasing lighting, et cetera.
And have you heard back from the businesses that you've worked with so far or the customers there about what it feels like to shop there then if you are someone who is suffering from dementia?
We have. We are really hearing a lot of positives both from the folks who live with memory challenges and their caregivers. And we're just really hearing people saying, thank you for doing this. It helps both caregivers and people living with those challenges to feel accepted. There's a stigma to having dementia, and our hope is that we get to a place where people are comfortable talking about it and sharing that they have this disability. It's a disease that causes these cognitive changes. So to be able to talk about it and to feel comfortable and to be accepted is really important.
And what would you say the benefits are to that business? I know you worked, for instance, with Walgreens recently. What are the benefits to making this commitment for the business itself?
They are hearing from their own customers that they shop there because they've had this training. They see the sticker, the Purple Angel sticker on the door, and they choose to shop in that store versus another store. So we're definitely hearing that, not just from Walgreens, but from Ace Hardware, for some of the other businesses, even churches are getting on board. And so people are choosing these businesses and organizations over another one because of this recognition that they've received and because of the efforts that they've made.
Now, this is hopefully for you just the beginning of the road. If you had a wish for the ultimate potential that this program could reach, how would you like to see Dane County transformed?
I would like to see every business, of course, eventually to have this this training, to have this awareness, to become involved, especially, you know, if they have customers coming in. I guess I hope that this Purple Angel, that when I go in to do a training, when I ask, you know, have you heard about Dementia Friendly, everyone in the room is going to say, of course we have, that this symbol become recognized, similar to the pink ribbon for breast cancer, that people just get it, just know that that means that people are understanding of folks with dementia, and that we are doing everything we can to support people in our community. So my hope is just that it's every day that people have this understanding.
Joy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joy Schmidt is a dementia care specialist with the Dane County Aging and Disability Resource Center, and she joined us to talk about a new program that helps businesses and government agencies become more dementia-friendly. You can find more information over on the Central Time Facebook page. We love our pets here on Central Time, and today is an opportunity for cat people, of which there are quite a few on the Central Time staff. And it turns out today is National Black Cat Appreciation Day, which also means it's a great opportunity to give a shout out to our little guy, Astro.
According to a source promoting the day, because of superstitious beliefs in some cultures, black cats are sometimes associated with bad luck. We've all heard that, black cat crossing your path. Sadly, they're more likely to be put to sleep or take a longer time to be adopted from shelters. Black Cat Appreciation Day was launched to encourage people to consider black cats for adoption.
So I have Astro.
Right.
He's a black kitty with a little bit of cute, a white star on his chest. You had a black cat, too.
We have, and growing up, we had black cats outside in our house. And I did have one instance where a black cat crossing my path was bad luck. It was winter. I was carrying firewood into the house. One of the black cats walked right into my path, sort of half tripped over it and fell and like dropped wood all over myself.
Oh, sure.
The cat.
Blame the cat.
The cat was unharmed.
Good. That's the important
thing.
And
I wouldn't have seen it because of all the firewood, no matter what color the cat was, I wasn't going to see it coming.
I think you need to adopt a new black cat.
Maybe. You know, the day may come.
Perhaps that day is today.
This is Central Time Appreciating Black Cats on the Ideas Network. Pussycat, pussycat, you're so thrilling, yeah.